today on Against the Grain. Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, these are names and designations that we use and we're used to. But do they make sense, given class differences within each group, immigration to the U.S., and race mixing? I'm C.S. David Hollinger calls a lot of conventional wisdom into question, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. In this country, we classify non-white people according to their color. We lump blacks together, and we do the same with Latinos and with other groups. And we say, to make universities and other institutions more diverse, we need more of this color or more of that color, and we add up the numbers. But what if some blacks are very different than other blacks, and some Asian Americans are very different than other Asian Americans, and so on? Are we matching the reward conferred with the wrong suffered if we don't distinguish, for example, children of rich immigrants to the U.S. from inner-city youth of the same color whose ancestors suffered under Jim Crow? David Hollinger believes that something's gone awry in the way we classify people, or more accurately, in the way that ethno-racial categories developed decades ago are still used in a nation transformed by immigration, race mixing, and other developments. David Hollinger is an historian and Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. He's the author of numerous books and articles on multiculturalism, solidarity, and cosmopolitanism, and he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and the problem of solidarity to the new volume, Cosmopolitanisms, edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. When David Hollinger joined me recently in studio, I asked him about W.E.B. Du Bois's famous statement that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line.
When Du Bois wrote that in 1903, he was speaking at the height of the Jim Crow era, when there were lynchings, not only all over the South, but in much of the Midwest as well. I mean, this is a period where the tightening of the racist, racially defined regime of the United States was going on all around him. So when he says that the problem of the 20th century is the color line, he means that this is an obstacle. The color line is an obstacle to justice, to equality, to a humane life, to democracy, that demands to be attended to, and that it's so important that it could be called the problem of the 20th century. Now, he was right, but one of the things that happens during the 20th century is that enough people understood how right he was that they diminished the problem. Now, this is a matter of degree. We all know that there's plenty of racism, especially anti-black racism, in the United States today, in 2017. But we have, after all, had a black president. We have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. There are many obvious changes that have occurred. And one of the striking changes is that the very concept of the color line, the very notion of race, has been interrogated much more critically in the last half century than it was during Du Bois's day. So now all our scholars and our pundits are eager to tell us how constructed these categories are. Now, the more constructed they become, which is to say the less primordial, the less these categories, these racial categories, these color categories are built into the human species, the less that, the more they become contingent products of human action. Now, if they're products of human action, then these categories become, you know, subject to change. And we are able to talk about the color line similar to other kinds of obstacles rather than something that's unique. It may be unique in its intensity. It may be unique in the scope that it has. It may be unique in its consequences, but it is not unique in its fundamental character. So that's a big change that's occurred, and I think it's partly due to the strength of the African-American liberation movement, of the civil rights movement, people like Du Bois, especially black people, but also their white allies.
And because of these changes that have occurred, you write that the problem of the 21st century is that of solidarity. How do you define solidarity?
Solidarity is a state of willed affiliation. I mean, if you talk about you have solidarity with someone, it means that you're making common cause with them, that you feel a special obligation to them, that you feel you can count on them to help you, that they're definitely part of a we, of some kind of willed community. Now, when I say that we're now in a position to describe the problem of solidarity as the problem of the 21st century, what I mean to get at there is that it's no longer taken for granted just what your we is. It's no longer so much taken for granted what your primary affiliation is. That we've had so many world historical changes, including migrations, regime change, large measure of ethno-racial mixing, so that a series of identities, a series of feelings of solidarity with some group or other, those adhesives, we might say, have diminished in force during the last 50 years, especially globalization, migration, ethno-racial mixture, cross-group marriage and reproduction. So now a lot of people are not quite so sure just who their we is. Who should they make common cause with? And it goes even right down to contemporary politics today, where we have all these quarrels about identity politics. And is it really important just to stand firm with the people that are the most like you? Or is it important to reach out and try to form common alliances with people who are different than yourself? Even within American politics, to say nothing about globally, do we have a global solidarity to deal with something like global warming and other world problems? Well, politicians disagree about that. We've seen that Donald Trump is pulling back from the notion of a global solidarity in regard to global warming and climate control. So I'd say that the situation that we face now as we go well into the 21st century is that more and more people are not sure that the inherited affiliations that they've had, they're not sure that the ascribed identities that they've been told that they have are the most important things. So people are asking the question, what do I mean by we? On just whom can I count for the most support? On just who do I owe the most support? I mean, what groups matter most to me, and where can I do the most to achieve, say, the goals of justice, equality, and democracy? Does this mean just sticking with your own kind? Well, if so, what does that mean? What is your own kind? Does it mean branching out to other groups and forming alliances with other groups? Well, if so, of what sort and at what cost? So solidarity becomes a problem when I talk about the problem of solidarity. Solidarity becomes a problem when you don't take what it is for granted. And I'm saying that world historical changes of the last couple of generations have made solidarity, rather than something that's taken for granted, a problem.
And when you say that older traditional identities are being disrupted and destabilized, you're talking, I just want to be specific here, about categories like African American or Asian American or Latino, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's primarily it, but it also applies to religious identities and local identities and national identities. We've had all this twaddle the last 20 or 30 years about post-nationalism. Well, I think the nation state is still pretty important and has a more constituent base than some of the post-national theorists think. But there are folks that say that the nation state is a thing of the past and that globalization has created a series of new formations, multinational corporations, alliances both on the left and the right, commercial connections that will render the old nation state redundant. Now, if that's the case, then it's national categories as well as ethnic, racial, and religious categories that are up for grabs, at least to some extent. So I see this as a species-wide challenge.
Okay, so we have this problem of solidarity, and it would be nice, wouldn't it, if there was kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to solving, to addressing this problem. Do you think such a approach, a solution exists?
I wish it was, but it really doesn't exist. And how people respond to the problem of solidarity and how they try to deal with it depends so much on historical, local conditions, constitutional regimes. What kind of political tools do you have? What sort of political culture are you surrounded by that you can count on? What is the demographic mixture of a particular locale? So as a result, how you deal with the problem of solidarity in, say, India, France, the United States, Canada, to use just democratic countries, it varies a little bit. So India is a case where they're massively committed to parceling out a lot of authority on the basis of ancestral groups. Well, there's a long tradition of that in India, and you have many people of more universalist inclinations that are critical of that and are trying to press against that. Then you have people like the Hindu nationalists that are actually trying to affirm those old identities. So that's an example of where the challenge is there are different than, say, for some of the European countries that are not immigrant-based, something like, say, Norway or Sweden or Denmark, where they do have these quarrels about just how to deal with the new immigrants that have come in and whether or not they're really part of the national we. But in the United States, where we are an immigrant-based society and have a migration-based sense of ourselves, there's a whole different political, ideological tradition. And there's a different constitutional tradition with a whole set of protections about minority rights and the whole federalist system. So even though it's possible to theorize it about it in general, how it's to be dealt with in a specific case varies enormously. But if one is going to talk about it in the round, the whole thing, talking about this in a species-wide way, you might say that what's at issue is a tension between two very worthy human aspirations. And the one is an aspiration toward intimacy and belonging. People need situations, surroundings, communities in which they feel a capacity for intimacy with other people and belonging. Then on the other hand, they need a way to deal with global questions, something like global warming or matters of human rights. Now, if you're dealing with those questions, intimacy and belonging are not so much in play. And so the trick is to come up with strategies, practices, regimes, political programs that respect what we might say, what you might even call the tribe, that respect the tribe, but at the same time respect the species.
David Hollinger joins me in studio. He's an historian and Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. And he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and the problem of solidarity to the new volume Cosmopolitanisms. He has a new book coming out soon. It's called Protestants Abroad, How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. There exists established what you call entrenched apparatuses for dealing with diversity in the U.S. So are we talking here about legal and other efforts to address discrimination and to rectify historical marginalization?
We are. We are talking about that. And when I say that they're entrenched, and I would even say many of them anachronistic, I have in mind an assumption which is behind many of these measures, many of these goodwill measures to diminish inequality and advance justice. What I have in mind is an assumption that all ethno-racial groups, all descent communities are enduring and clearly bounded and analogically structured, each possessed of its own myth of diaspora and its own dynamics for solidarity. Now, that assumption was very widespread in the the late 1980s and down through much of the 1990s, when affirmative action programs were solidified, when the ideal of multiculturalism advanced. It's interesting that when the affirmative action programs were first put in the very late 60s and early 1970s, if you go back over the hearings and the records of the congressional hearings, and if you read the op-eds, and if you read the manifestos of the various advocates, it's all about black people. It's not about Hispanics. It's not about Indians. It's not about Asian Americans. But then what happens is that once it's in place for African Americans, a lot of people are sort of scratching their head and say, well, wait a minute, African Americans are not the only people that are disadvantaged. So federal agencies and courts begin putting all these other categories in there. And the assumption is that all these non-white descent communities, communities of descent, people of common ancestry, people who bear the physical marks of descent, black, brown, yellow, and so forth, that they're all somehow sort of alike. So the multiculturalist movement and the affirmative action plans are set up this way. Well, you know, it works up to a point. It does deal with genuine injustices. It does call attention in educational programs that are multicultural. It does call attention to the plurality and the diversity of American life and to many of the hierarchies and injustices that are involved in that. But it also ignores a lot of differences within these groups. And an example of how what I'm calling this anachronistic stuff continues is that as late as 1998, when President Clinton convened his national initiative on race, they came out with a list of 58 recommendations for change, not a single one of which dealt with the unique situation of black people in the United States. And if you go through that document, the Commission on Race of 1998, you see that the commissioners systematically and purposely diminished the differences between African Americans on the one hand and Asian Americans on the other, even though by that time we had commanding statistics about how differently black people were affected by racism in the United States than Asian Americans. Asian Americans have been subject to racism in the United States, no question about it. But an accurate account of this would pay a lot more attention to the differences along the way. Black people are uniquely disadvantaged in the United States through a multi-century legacy of enslavement, Jim Crow policies, racialization, miscegenation legislation that puts them in a much lower class position. Many Asian American peoples, particularly of the era since about 1970 when the new migration comes in, many of the Asian Americans enter the United States with very high educational level. Most of the Koreans that come to the United States are college graduates. English fluency is very common. Now, there's a spectrum within the Asian American population, okay. But in 1998, if you're trying to do any kind of statistical analysis of the different communities of descent in the United States, they have very different histories and presumably might invite different policies for equity. As a result of the failure to revise this old assumption, we do not get fresh thinking about how to deal with inequality in the United States.
So you're saying essentially that there needs to be more precision applied to these categories, or maybe these categories need to be changed, like the traditional ethno-racial categories of Hispanic and Asian American and Native American and African American, in order to make sure what? That the truly deserving people are given special treatment as opposed to a bunch of other groups, in this case subgroups of these groups, that may not need the assistance offered by these programs?
I would put it a little bit differently. I mean, I can understand why people put it that way. I would say that in the interest of public policy and national self-knowledge, it would be good that we had a census system that would count people in more accurate categories. For example, if we were to count people by national origin rather than race, then you might come up with, in any congressional district, where the Vietnamese are, where the Chinese are, where the Japanese are, where the African Americans are. And for the purpose of enforcing anti-discrimination remedies in elections, as well as many others, you'd have a set of categories that then you could use or not use depending on the policy goal. For example, with regard to Hispanics, well, does that include Argentinians? Well, they're mostly from Italy and Spain. So there's a strong European base there. What about Portuguese? So that the difficulty with the Hispanic category, if it's not broken down, is that it conflates a lot of very different historical circumstances and different degrees of debasement and discrimination within American history. So a lot of us who've been arguing about the census for the last 15 or 20 years have suggested that we do need different categories. So it's not just a matter of like who's deserving. It's a matter of where inequalities have been the most deeply ingrained in American life and where people have a greater capacity to get beyond them. I mean, it's very interesting within the African-American population, for example, that the immigrant groups from Jamaica, from the Caribbean, and from Kenya and Nigeria, these Americans are much better able to overcome the barriers created by white supremacy than the descendants of American slavery and Jim Crow and the whole institutionalized debasement of black people that's such a prominent part of the history of the United States.
So you're saying that studies have shown that immigrants of African descent to the United States, they do better in the face of anti-black racism than African Americans?
No question about it. And then the question becomes, well, who is an African American? I mean, are we going to count the descendants of the new immigrants? Well, maybe we should. But remember Barack Obama himself, whose blackness follows from immigration, not from the history of slavery and Jim Crow like his wife's. Obama himself used to say that it's not clear at all that his daughter should get the benefits of affirmative action. So that's an example of what is a real challenge as to how go about designing those programs. I like to say that the system that we've got is sort of like a world map that's a Mercator projection. So it's great for the purposes of putting up everything up on the wall, but Greenland is really large and Ecuador and Indonesia are really small as a result of the Mercator projection. Well, our whole system of ethno-racial classification meets certain purposes, sort of like the purpose of having a big wall map. But there are other purposes it doesn't reach at all, and that's why I'm saying there's something anachronistic about it.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Hollinger joins us. He is an author, an historian, a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. His books include Cosmopolitanism and Solidarity, Studies in Ethno-Racial, Religious, and Professional Affiliation in the United States, and Post-Ethnic America, Beyond Multiculturalism, among other books. And he contributed an article about cosmopolitanism and solidarity to a new volume. It's called Cosmopolitanisms, and it's published by New York University Press. So if we stick with this issue of people of African descent, and so we have African Americans, but we also have people coming from regions like the Caribbean and from Africa and from many other places, how big of an issue is it for you that, let's say, they're all lumped together for purposes of universities reporting that, you know, we accepted so many blacks or so many blacks matriculated here, and here, therefore, is a sign of our efforts to address diversity on campus. How big of an issue is it that perhaps a significant portion of those blacks are, in fact, immigrants?
Is it? How important is it? Well, I think it is important because it's easy for people to be misled about cause and effect. It's easy for people to be misled in thinking that all blacks are alike, and they're not. On the other hand, any progress is valuable. I mean, if black people have been discriminated against in colleges, then we need more black people in colleges. And so I can understand why people have gone the direction that they have. But we need to also remember that these efforts to deal with the injustices experienced by African Americans are part of a larger system. And we need ways of dealing with one part of the system that also work in other parts of the system. And it's in that context that, you know, the word cosmopolitanism has come more into vogue the last few years. And it might be worth saying something about that. And since you just mentioned this book, I want to observe that the new popularity of the word cosmopolitanism comes about in the context of a long history of two other words that were often used to talk about how to deal with the injustices experienced by African Americans in particular, and also by other non-white groups. Now, those other two terms were pluralism and universalism. And when people talked about pluralism, there was an effort to recognize many different groups in American life and many different groups in the world. And you were pluralistic if you overcame a bias against any of these groups. So you develop a sense of the equality of all groups. So pluralists affirm the diversity of the society and of the world. They tend to want to defend the integrity, they would say, of the different groups. Now, the universalists come along and they're less interested in group integrity than they are in applying universal rules of justice. So they would want to say that what matters is not so much what your group identity is, but that you're a human being. So you have policies that would try to deal with everybody equally. Now, for a long time, pluralism and universalism were sort of united against bias, against ethnocentrism, against racism, against provincialism. And often the word cosmopolitanism was used as a synonym for those. So cosmopolitans, pluralists, universalists, they're all sort of against racism and so on. But what's happened the last 40 or 50 years is that the deficiencies of both pluralism and universalism have become more apparent. Going back to this earlier point I made about the tension between the two goals, tribal goals, intimacy and belonging. You have to have a set of community where people can actually do stuff together. And on the other hand, global justice, dealing with global warming, dealing with large problems, problems of large scale. So what the cosmopolitans do is they come in and they say, look, pluralism is too oriented to the group. It's too inclined to defend traditional groups. It's too resistant to new alliances. And the universalists are too oblivious to the needs that human beings have for communities with intimacy and belonging. So the universalists come along and say, well, everybody's all alike. We just need programs that will treat everybody equally. So the cosmopolitans then come into this and say, well, now it's a little bit more complicated. I mean, we've got to deal with both of these needs. And it's there that these differences between the national cultures and the constitutional regimes come about. So a cosmopolitan in India might be operating on a different basis than a cosmopolitan in the United States. So, yes, the situation in African Americans is absolutely central to any understanding of these problems in the United States, no question about it. But how we deal with it, bringing us back to Du Bois, puts us in the larger question of the color line, not only black and white, but other color lines. And that puts us in the larger context of the problem of solidarity.
How would you feel, David, if we kept the ethno-racial categories, and I know you don't want to do that, but just hang in there with me. We kept the ethno-racial categories as they were, but we added a consideration that related to economic situation, to economic marginalization. Then would we be closer in your mind to something that serves the interest of justice when it comes to programs dealing with diversity?
I would say yes, in that it's so hard to make any changes in the situation that we have that piecemeal changes like that can help. Because what we have been doing in many cases is to use an ethno-racial category as a proxy for an economic condition. For example, if you talk about the population that the Census Bureau calls Hispanic, Latino, Hispanic, okay, well, here you have a population that, as a result of American policies, recruits poorly educated people from Latin American countries so that they can perform certain kinds of labor in the United States. So we talk about the disadvantages that the Hispanic population has, and much of it has to do with an economic conditions which is specifically mandated by American immigration and business policies. Whereas the Asian American population, it's very different. I mean, you're recruiting all these engineers and very high-tech people from India and throughout Asia. So the pre-immigration base is economically very different. So I think that to add economic situation to it would help a little bit. But as I said earlier, I think we're much better off junking the concept of race altogether and going with national origin, which we can then correlate with the economic statistics that is also gathered by the Census Bureau.
That's the voice of David Hollinger. He's Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus of History at UC Berkeley, and we are talking about his work on cosmopolitanism. He calls the problem of the 21st century the problem of solidarity. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with David. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Hollinger joins me. He is a professor emeritus of history at UC Berkeley, and he's written books like Cosmopolitanism and Solidarity and After Cloven Tongues of Fire, Protestant Liberalism and Modern American History. And we are talking about an essay he contributed to a new volume. It's called Cosmopolitanisms. It's edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. So, David, you were talking about economics as being an important factor. You had also alluded earlier to the educational background of people coming to the U.S., immigrants, whether it be the person themselves who is at issue or the parents of the person, let's say a student who comes over here to a university and the university is wondering how to deal with them in terms of whether they see the addition of this person as increasing diversity on campus. So how would you weigh economics versus education and educational background as factors, as important factors to take into account?
It's very difficult to separate out education from economic position because very often more highly educated individuals are able to make more money, have a higher household income to support themselves and their families. And if you have a strong enough economic base, then you're more likely to be able to educate your own children. So it continues in that way. So I guess I'm reluctant to separate out too much the economy from the educational status. Both are very important. But if you begin with either of the two, you're much more likely to advance the second.
And you are arguing, or are you not arguing, that the power of racism to damage people differs depending on their economic or educational circumstance?
I think that the class position of all historically disadvantaged ethno-racial groups in the United States does affect how they are treated by empowered whites and by the establishment. And this is not something that I just thought up. We've got all these sociologists that have been studying race and class in American society for a very long time. And the cases that are quite striking within the African-American population have to do indeed with, say, the Ethiopians the Nigerians than the Jamaicans, as opposed to people who are the descendant of many generations of Jim Crow in Mississippi, and for that matter, racism in the North. So that's an empirically warranted difference about the capacity of these people to overcome the barriers of white racism. Now, within, say, the Asian American population, there's also a huge difference between the Hmong and some of the other Asian ethnic groups that come in with very weak class position, with poor educational background, with very little commercial experience. And so there's a great difference between them and the average migrant from Hong Kong, Taiwan, or South Korea, which generally come in with commercial skills, high degree of literacy, often English fluency, makes a big difference as to how you can get ahead in the society. So I'm just saying that there's a great variety of behaviors and situations of non-white groups in the United States. And people who identify with cosmopolitan aspirations are usually eager to see policies developed that recognize these differences.
What about the mixing of different races as a result of marriage and reproduction across racial lines? What should we know about that?
I think that's very important because it cuts against this old assumption that a black is a black, a brown is a brown, a yellow is a yellow, and so forth, and requires a little bit more sensitivity in how we classify these people. So our statistics on cross-group marriage and reproduction over the last 30 years have increased greatly, even with black-white marriages, which is the lowest level, but it's still much higher than it used to be. Blacks and whites are now marrying one another about four or five times as often as Jews and non-Jews did in 1940. Doesn't mean that we'll have follow the same trajectory, but it does mean that the direction is at least the same, even if it doesn't reach the same statistics eventually. So yes, ethno-racial mixture, very big thing in the United States, and needs to be addressed much more frontally, I think, by discussants of this whole cluster of issues.
David Hollinger joins us. He's Professor Emeritus of History at UC Berkeley. And if we get back to this issue of solidarity, I mean, at the beginning of this hour, you defined it as willed affiliation, kind of voluntary affiliation. And yet, in some ways, I feel like what we've been talking about is not so much willed affiliation, but how people should be viewed, how people should be, what categories they should be placed in by people overseeing diversity issues in the U.S. So can you clarify this for me? Like, how does what you're saying address the problem of solidarity?
The census is a system by which individuals are told what matters about them. The census tells people that you are either this, that, or the other, and you choose between these old race categories. So even if you have an opportunity to click one rather than another, these are ascribed categories rather than chosen categories. And the individual filling out the forms is expected to choose the ascribed category. That's why people get so agitated whenever there's some press story about some white person claiming to be black or some black person claiming to be white. But the system that we have is one that tells people what their identity is. Now, identity is, after all, performative. And that's why it's so connected with solidarity. So when I talk about willed affiliation, solidarity as willed affiliation, I'm talking about what many people mean when they invoke the concept of identity. The term identity is very misleading, however, because many people take it to refer to something that's fixed and primordial, when all our social scientists and historians keep telling us that these identities are products of history. Now, the difference between a willed affiliation and something that's not willed is when you don't have any doubts about what your identity is, who you have solidarity with, either because you've never been given any choice in the matter, because of, you know, racialization, for example. You've never been given any choice in the matter, or you've never experienced the historical circumstances that call into question what the assumption is about your identity, which is to say your capacity, your obligation for dealing with other people, who you can count on, what your solidarity is. But when historical circumstances then challenge that identity, challenge that affiliation, suggest that there are other kinds of people that you might want to affiliate with and that you have interests that are better served by affiliation with them rather than those that you're constantly told you should affiliate with, well, that's what I mean about willed affiliation. The problem of solidarity, it doesn't become a problem until there's at least some agency involved. An identity that is not willed is something that's just taken for granted. Whereas if you have any choice in the matter at all, then it becomes a matter of will. That's when the concept of solidarity becomes operative.
My guest David Hollinger has a new book coming out later this year. It's called Protestants Abroad: How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. And this book is about missionary cosmopolitanism, so it relates to, you know, what we've been talking about this hour, which is cosmopolitanisms. What is missionary cosmopolitanism? What is this book about?
This is a book about the American Protestants who go abroad in the early and mid 20th century to places like China and India and Japan and the Arab societies of Western Asia especially. And when they're over there, they often decide that making the rest of the world more like American Protestants isn't such a good idea after all. So they come back to the United States. They and their children come back to the United States, and they begin arguing against American provincialism. They begin arguing against home truths. They begin arguing against a lot of the ideas that are very common in the American Protestant communities that sent them abroad. I call them missionary cosmopolitans because they come back with this much more global vision, with a sense that we really need to be engaging global problems, if not on a universalist basis, on some basis that recognizes the integrity of these different communities. These people go abroad as you might call, let's see, they're claiming to be universalists because they believe that Christianity is the universal answer to everything. And they change their mind when they develop respect for the local communities that they find in China and India and all over the world. So they become cosmopolitans in the very sense that I'm talking about it, in that they retain a vision of a species-wide welfare, that they want everybody to sort of be better off. But they decide that one answer doesn't fit all, and particularly Protestant Christianity doesn't fit all. So they come back and they say, well, you know, it's okay for us Presbyterians here in Dubuque, Iowa, to continue to do our thing, but we shouldn't expect everybody in the world to follow suit. And the whole idea of going abroad to change them was not a good idea. So these folks, the missionary cosmopolitans, they then develop service programs, and they decide that what Shanghai needs is not more Christians, but more medical schools and a variety of service programs like that. So their activities abroad change, and their impact back on the home culture changes as well. So they're, I call them missionary cosmopolitans because it is a variety of cosmopolitanism that enters American life through the Protestant Missionary Project.
And what kind of impact and in what arenas did these returning missionaries and their children have on attitudes and on policy?
They turn up in a remarkable number of arenas of American public life. We've been talking a lot about race and ethnicity in American life in the more recent period. But if you go back to the 1940s and you're looking around for Anglo-Protestants who were really involved in civil rights for black people, these missionary characters were just extravagantly overrepresented. I mean, you go to one setting after another where the leaders of the black civil rights movement, the NAACP and so forth, when they're trying to get white allies, and okay, they got the Communist Party. There's been a lot of discussion of that. But they also had a lot of these missionaries. So if you go through the records of what's going on in the 1940s in civil rights, you find that missionary-connected American Protestants are really big. So that's one. But another, moving now away from some of the domains of American life that we've been talking about here, CS, moving into some other stuff, these missionary cosmopolitans are very prominent in the State Department, in the Foreign Service, in American intelligence agencies. It also applies, you know, outside of government in public discussion about what American foreign policy should be. Now, the main theme that you find in these domains, the State Department, the Foreign Service, the OSS, the CIA, and public discussion about foreign policy, the main theme that you find there is in some ways parallel to this pro-civil rights sort of pre-multiculturalist stuff that you get when they're talking about domestic policy. What you get when missionary cosmopolitanism applies itself to foreign affairs is a conviction that the interest of the United States should be closely allied with the self-defined interests of the non-white decolonizing peoples of the rest of the world. So these characters, and they're in the State Department, they're involved in constant fights with other State Department officers who whose tradition has been to deal with the European colonial powers. So I have one guy who shows up in 1941, former missionary to Thailand, and he's brought in to meet with all these generals and the top State Department brass. And the first thing he says is, what you guys need to understand is that the British Empire is done in Asia. And if there's going to be any future over there, the United States has to take over the military role of the British Empire. Now, he wasn't advocating this. He was just saying, look, the world is changing, and the whole era of European colonialism and imperialism is about to be over. Well, they didn't want to hear this in 1941. They didn't want to hear it. But that's an interesting example, CS, because it's a case of where missionary-connected people were very early in developing a line that then becomes quite popular later on when people are saying, hey, the United States was too closely connected to the old colonial powers, and we should have been doing stuff that was a little bit more patient with the nationalist movements of the decolonizing world. So foreign affairs is another of the big areas. I'll just mention briefly, there are really quite a lot of these, that others is the churches themselves. I mean, these missionaries really change American churches. They turn them in ecumenical directions, anti-sectarian directions, greater political involvement. The social gospel, which a lot of people associate with the early 20th century, social gospel gets a huge push in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s from missionaries.
How ironic is it that, as you write, an enterprise driven by ethnocentrism and cultural imperialism, we're talking about the missionary enterprise, and often linked closely with military, diplomatic, and economic imperialism, generated the reaction you're describing in the hearts and minds and activities in U.S. of missionaries and their children and their affiliates?
This is a great argument for diversity, because it's an example of how people who had not been exposed to very much outside a Western Christian, particularly Protestant culture, when they are really deeply immersed in this foreign stuff, they overcome a lot of biases that were generated by their own parochialism. And the missionary case is especially worth talking about in the degree of immersion in things foreign. Because I found that a lot of the Americans who live abroad in business families, military families, diplomatic families, experience some of this deprovincialization, but not nearly as much, because they don't stay as long in the same location. They don't have as much incentive to learn the local languages and cultures. Or as what happens with the missionary types is that they go for a long time, and they're embedded in these communities. And many of the children of missionaries are bilingual at birth, and many of them say that they learned their Chinese or their Japanese before they learned English. So when these folks come back to the United States, they have a whole wealth of experience that's quite unusual in the U.S. Now, This is partly a chronologically bounded situation, because after World War II, when the United States is much more involved all over the world, there are other sources for understanding the non-European world, and the significance of the missionary clique diminishes considerably. Also, missions largely dry up among the more well-educated ecumenical liberal denominations. But what had happened in World War II is that suddenly the United States has a desperate need for people who know these foreign languages and know something about these societies. So there are a lot of cases where people would show up in Washington, missionary types, and they would discover that they were the only ones around that knew anything. Like when Edwin Reischauer, the great scholar of Japanese studies at Harvard for many years after the war, and later ambassador to Japan, actually, when Edwin Reischauer showed up in 1942, actually, right after Pearl Harbor, shows up in Washington to take over his group about Japanese language training, everybody in the room was, like him, a missionary son or a former missionary. So the missionaries had almost a monopoly on deep knowledge of many aspects of the world at the start of World War II. And as a result of that, a lot of these people get catapulted into positions of enormous influence. And therefore, missionary cosmopolitanism becomes a prominent feature of American life, especially in the 1940s and 1950s. Yes, it is ironic. It is ironic that something generated out of ethnocentrism and cultural imperialism has the opposite effect. But one of the things that I keep stressing in this book is that it's a validation of a vindication of contact theory, which the sociologists tell us is the idea that if you spend a lot of time abroad where you really get to know different kinds of people, it does affect your attitudes. So the contact theorists among sociologists, Gordon Allport was an example of that. They tell us that one of the reasons that gays and lesbians are more respected in the United States today is because a lot of people that didn't realize there were any around suddenly found out that their nephew was gay. And that so the proximity of what had been a stigmatized group really made a difference. So contact theory, as it applies to race, to sexual orientation, a lot of things, makes a big difference. So contact theory is relevant to my missionary story because you have a population that really didn't know very much about South Asian society. Then you get a lot of Presbyterians and Congregationalists. They go over there and they spend a couple generations there, and then they come back and say, hey, you know, we shouldn't be worried so much about Hinduism. I mean, it's different than what we got, but it ain't so bad. So you have missionaries writing these treatises defending the other religions of the world against Christian imperialism.
David Hollinger talking about his forthcoming book, Protestants Abroad, How Missionaries Tried to Change the World but Changed America. It will be published by Princeton University Press. David is Preston Hotchkiss Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley. We've also been talking about his article in the new volume Cosmopolitanisms, edited by Bruce Robbins and Paulo Lemos Horta. David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.